that many turns. Again, type 43 material specified has an AL value of a little over a microhenry per turn squared. So one pass through that toroid gives you already one microhenry of inductance. And you really don't even need more than about 16 to 20 microhenries to cover the entire HF band between 3.5 and 30 in a 50-ohm system. So he's very much overdoing it, and I'm a little concerned that he might be using that thing above self-resonance. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I think I mentioned to him that that was kind of excessive. I mean, I think perhaps he's developed this idea about the seven turns because he was building 49 to 1 on him for the NFED, and that's a 7 to 1 turn ratio, so it's usually 14 to 2. So I think that's where Rich might have gotten the idea of 14 turns, which is a lot of turns for just RF choking.
Yeah, what's going on with 49 to 1? The impedance is much, much higher than 50 ohms and several thousand ohms. So there you need more inductance. But if you're staying in a 50 ohm system, the antenna is roughly 50 ohms or somewhere between 50 and 75 ohms. And of course, the feed line going down to the transmitter is 50 ohms, and the transmitter output impedance is designed to look into 50 ohms. You certainly don't need and you certainly don't want all that inductance. It just isn't necessary and it could give you trouble.
Yeah, I agree, Mike. I just think that he might have gotten the 14 number from that 49 to 1 ballot. Is that possible, Rich?
No, I got that number from the design of a 1 to 1 ballot.
That's too many times. If you want to stay with type 43 material, that is.
Mike, how many turns should I try? About, should I try half, seven, or less than that?
Hold on one second. I'll tell you a more quantitative number. Hold on. Okay, six turns will give you 36 microhenries of inductance, which is more than enough. So six turns through the toroid should be more than enough to cover the entire HF band. Assuming, again, I'm assuming it is 43 material. If you decide you want to use 61 material, which is another possibility, there you'd need more turns because the AL value there is only about 200 nanohenries per turn squared, five times less than it would be for type 43. But for type 43, six turns should do it.
Mike, as long as you're doing these calculations, what would it be for type 31?
Type 31 is 200 nanohenries roughly per turn square. My battery just died. I would say eight to 10 turns for type 31.
Okay, thanks.
Wait, 61, not 31. 61.
No, but I asked about 31.
I don't have the AL value for 31 at my disposal. What is it, you know?
No, I don't have it available, but it's a very common mixture.
I don't know what the AL value is offhand. I would have to look it up.
Okay, thanks anyway.
Have to go through about an inch of hot glue to get to the terminals, but I'll definitely undo it in the next couple of days.
Okay, I wish you luck as always, Rich. Once again, if you have nothing better to do, I would run the time domain reflectometer before you do it and just kind of put it to the side, and it might be an interesting thing to look at.
What am I looking for when I do that TDR? At exact, to see if the length is correct, is returning the length correctly?
Well, it's, to a degree it's the length, but it's also, hopefully it should read a somewhat constant 50 ohm impedance from the point of your test equipment all the way to the antenna feed point. Then it gets wonky because of the antenna installed beyond it. So, you know, if I forget what you said, if it's 30 feet of coax and you see the 30 feet nice constant 50 ohms and then you see all kinds of strangeness, then it could theoretically still be the feed point or the RF choke at the feed point, but at least you've removed the 30 feet of coax cable, at least, you know, as far as the nano VNA can discern any impedance mismatches and the connection problems brought there.
Right, I'll give that a try with the rig experts, VNA. All right, guys, thanks so much. You know, I really, first of all, I learned so much about antennas just doing this stuff. And with your guys, you know, feedback and all that, I learned that much more. So I really do appreciate it. Back to Net, WPBZ.
Well, you're welcome, Rich, and thanks to Mike, and thanks to John. It's always nice to have electrical engineers in the audience, so I appreciate your presence with us.
Oh, my pleasure there, Roy. No problem at all. I'm trying to get the AL value for 31 material, so I ain't found it yet. If I can find it, let me break in and I'll give you a number.
Okay, very good. I'd appreciate it. Most of my material that I work with tends to be MiG-31, so rather than turn Taurus for the most part, I tend to clamp something like 6 to 8 big chunky clip-on 31 ferrite as RF chokes to my system.
Okay, I found it here. The permeability is twice as much as it is for type 43, so the AL value should be twice as much. So 40% less turns than type 43 material would give you the same inductance, Rick.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I thought 31 would be a bit more effective for these things. I've recently purchased a few Tauruses so that I could kind of test out their function. I've talked to people who aren't really that thrilled with clamp-ons. They seem to indicate that if you don't have a perfect match for the two halves, there's a gap. It undermines its capability to concentrate the magnetic flux. It's not as good as a toroid in their opinion. So I'm trying those things out as well.
Yeah, it depends on how good that plastic jacket secures the two halves. Whoever gave that information is quite correct. If there is a gap, the permeability drops rather quickly, even for very small gaps on the order of 30 seconds of an inch. You're not going to get the same permeability that you would have if you had a gap of course. There might be something you can do about that. Put some kind of material in there just to guarantee that they get a little closer together as you close that piece of plastic around it. That would probably work. Or don't use the plastic at all. Just take the two halves and put them together and tape them. That's usually what I do anyway. By the way, the one bad news about type 31 material is that the permeability peaks pretty quickly at 10 megahertz and then drops like a stone. So I'm not sure how good it's going to be at 30. It's very good at lower frequency, but it dies like a stone above 10.
Okay, but generally you need less impedance as you go higher and higher. So I don't know. I've used it. That's pretty much been my RF choke of choice. I haven't really seen any particular problems, but I'll have to reassess that.
Oh, yeah, that's quite correct. The impedance is not as inductive reactive, I should say, remains relatively constant in ohms, even though the permeability starts to drop off. I'm just comparing the two curves between type 43 and 31, and 43 holds its own up to about 50 megahertz, and 31 drops pretty quickly to less than one-fifth. Wow, very quickly. But I guess, yeah, I see what you're saying. It should work anyway if you have enough inductance to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I had it figured up front, that it's the inductive reactance that counts, giving you the impedance. If it stays pretty constant despite the frequency rise, and that's all I kind of ask out of life.
Indeed so. Okay, very good, guys. Let me sit by and listen. I don't know if you have any more takers. I just kind of came in late, but I'll give it back to you there, Roy, and enjoying the net tonight. Thanks a lot for the opportunity. We'll catch you later. WY2U.
Well, thanks for the assist, Mike. Yeah, we have one gentleman waiting to be heard. Hopefully, as time goes on, a few other people will check in as well with either questions or comments. Anyone else want to make a comment before we move on to the next topic?
PhD with one comment on the question.
Yes, certainly, Jim.
While the theory of this is very weak on, I happen to have on my bench a stack of 43 and 31 toroids that are doing just what the same job as what we're talking about here. And they're pretty big. They're like 2 3/8 inches across. They're specifically picked to wrap coax versus individual wires inside of a box. And my understanding is that you use a different size if you wrap a coax versus wrapping individual wires. Perhaps that's a factor that's coming into effect. That's all I have on that.
Okay, I mean, as far as I'm aware, it's more of a mechanical concern. You don't want to make particularly sharp turns with coaxial cables because it's very important to keep the center conductor in the center of the dielectric. If you make too sharp a turn, you might force the wire closer to the shielding, and that will distort the impedance at that point. So you don't want to do that. So I think the only thing is that it has to do with is just the mechanical aspect of a coax winding as opposed to a enameled, copper wire type of situation where you don't have to concern yourself with sharp turns causing any problems in the conductor.
Sounds right to me.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll go from Jim's addendum to Jim's question. So next up is Jim, KD2BHB. What's your question or your topic for tonight, Jim?
Well, my topic is technical and ham radio related, but it's not electronic. And it may or may not be the appropriate form for it, but I'll throw it out there and you can say what you'd like to do with it. I think we spoke about this the other day a little bit. There seems to be a rise in unlicensed operators. I've been seeing it on the GMRS services also, and here on this computer. The advent of the open radios for cheap is definitely coming to fruition. And I've heard a number of different ways to approach the offending individual. And I was looking for some input because none of them seem to be very effective. Is there any conversation to be had on how to handle that in a effective manner that's also ambassador-like? If you'd rather not discuss it here, that's fine, but I figured I'd bring it up.
No, Jim, it's no problem. You got a license, I got a license. We can talk about it. It's up for many arguments, and there are differing opinions. The general opinion that's especially presented in repeaters is to behave as though they don't exist, to kind of ghost them. They come on, they try to engage people in conversation, and you do not respond. That isn't always what people do. Last week, a gentleman presented himself and said that he was blind and might have been confused of what radio he was using and what settings he was using. And so I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt and told him where he was and that he shouldn't be here and the different routes that he could still interact with the technical net and not violate FCC rules. I don't know whether he was legit or not. And I'm sure there were people who said, you know, you should have ghosted him. You should have done what you're supposed to do. I've seen very bad examples. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you the worst example. Because unfortunately, people who do this tend to do it because they want to get attention. I think they live lives, dreary little lives, where no one bothers to listen to them, and they really desire interaction with people, and so they will troll. They will try to get a ride. And one of the worst cases I ever saw, heard, was a repeater where, one of the licensed amateur radio operators just berated this guy, and the jammer berated back, and they finally turned the repeater off, but the ham was so annoyed that he switched to the frequency of the repeater, and he kept on berating the jammer. And the jammer apparently loved it. He kept it going for an hour or something. It was an act of insanity on both of their parts. So the best sideline, unfortunately, is to ghost them. That's very unrewarding to many people. You want to, tell them to give them a kick in the ass and tell them what to do, but that usually doesn't go very well, ultimately.
Sounds like good advice. That fills out the theory a little bit better. I appreciate that. Are there any others that have any input onto the techniques to use?
Gosh, the silence is deafening, guys and gals. Hopefully there's gals out there. Anyone want to hazard any other opinions? I'm sure this is one of the many topics for discussion where there are differing opinions. There are the usual opinion of ghosting, and then there are the offshoots. So if anyone has anything to say, feel free. CDH for the comment. Yes, John.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was Eric, maybe KGJ, I think he had some active CF going on where they were able to isolate and the person that was forging the offense. I remember there was a case on this receiver a few years ago that was, I think it made it into the newspaper.
Well, yeah, I mean, the technical staff, including our own Lou and NY2H, was involved in Raspberry Pi, dongle SDR, Doppler, range finding and timing and mapping of transmission so that you could look into a map and see the approximate location of the individual that's transmitting at the time. And, when you listen to a jammer, it tells you that the guy's sitting there in Queens, so you have a reasonable, narrower location to look for them. And there have been repeated unfortunate episodes of jamming. I remember there was a point where Dick, K2RIW, really got annoyed at everything. And one Sunday morning, Sunday evening at 8 p.m., he ka-chunked the repeater, he opened his mouth, and guys jammed him. And he could hear because he always listened to his signal. And he just couldn't take it anymore. He put the microphone down, and he walked away from the TechNet for about 2-3 weeks until you know, people gave them the impression that they were going to really try and get to the to these people. So yeah, we have had many ingenious people come up with ingenious ways of finding these people. Still very, very difficult. Some of these guys who are very malicious will do it moving in a car, so you won't find where their shack, their primary location is. They travel very close to repeaters and try and overpower things. And, you know, it's unfortunate. It's real antisocial behavior. It's a shame that they have to spend their lives wasting it that way.
Well, yeah, I guess it's all part of the general increase in lawlessness time.
Well, it's probably a combination of a lot of factors. Easy availability for some. Some of the most annoying jammers actually had sophisticated patients. So, you know, they probably enough expertise that they wouldn't have a problem passing the exam, but they're kind of antisocial, I guess. So they never would take up the exam. There was one guy who used to fake someone else's call sign and have conversations on repeaters regularly. And I sort of heard the guy, and it didn't make any particular sense because he talked about how he had a UHF-VHF station on one side of his room and a HF station on the other side of the room. But the call sign that he stole from someone else had a tech license. So tech licenses don't really lend much to HF. So that's when I first figured out that something strange is going on. When I listened closely to his voice, I picked up the same voice in other jamming attempts where he wasn't making believe he was a ham. So it's a weird world. The psychodynamics of people who spend time, money, and learn things just for the sake of making a mess, it strikes me as kind of bizarre.
Well, yeah, some
seems
of it
to
is,
me
I
that
think,
the chronic
psychology
problems
of,
like you're talking
going to
about are easier to decide what to do
once
you got to find them out.
From the situation,
go that route.
But
the other one that we've seen recently on this band, and like I said, GMRS, I also use that service. And they seem to be of a different nature. They're more transient and more exploratory, and it almost seems like there might be some way to kind of dissuade them. It's not, they're not fully pathologic at this point. I guess that's what I was looking for, some successful solutions to that type of issue.
Okay, unfortunately, you doubled a little bit with John. I'll ask him to repeat himself in a second. I think you're alluding more to what some people call Baofeng kitty. You know, guys who go to, I don't know, Kmart or whatever, and it's bubble packed on a shelf or on a display case, and, you know, they spend the entire $30. They get themselves a Baofeng, they twirl the dial, they hear people talking, and they just go for it without any understanding of what they're doing. So, you know, it's very difficult to discern exactly what the intent of individuals are. Usually amateur radio tends to have a little bit higher walls, so you have to kind of actively, maliciously know what you're doing. But I'm sure there are other bands where it's easier to just kind of goof your way into them. So, you know, you could make a case for giving people a kind of a first case benefit of the doubt and explaining that what they're doing is wrong. And then if you ever hear them again, fall back to the old ghosting theory. John, you wanted to say something.
No, the only thing I mentioned was that some of the psychology has to do with feeling that you're going through a repeater, that you're one level from the situation, which is not really the case because you're just looking on the input. But I don't know. I remember on HF, you occasionally would have somebody that would lose somebody else's call, but I think here on VHF with the repeaters, they think they're one level isolated from it.
Okay, I never really got deeply into it. I never actually knew personally a jammer, except by reputation and hearing his entries onto repeaters. You know, occasionally, unfortunately, you have amateur radio operators who turn to the dark side of the force. We have had a few who were sort of borderline jammers that have become silent keys. So, you know, they're not doing that anymore, but you know, it's probably the worst situation, as far as I feel, is when one of your own kind of goes down that path. You know, that's don't know, that's worse to me than some jerk who just bought a valve bug and is playing around with it.
It's like going through the dark side of
the valve bug. Description you gave is what I've noticed in the last couple of weeks. It seems to be, you know, ineptness rather than malfeasance. Malfeasance is a whole different animal. I think we're all on the same page. You have to deal with that. But these bumbling explorers, I think maybe there's a more thoughtful solution to heading them in the right direction.
Well, I would assume that would be education. Like I mentioned earlier, last week, and I'm sure there were a few people with little clipboards who kind of decide what's amateur radio, what's not, what's right, what's wrong, kind of didn't like me suggesting to, I think he gave his name as Ivan, but I could be mistaken, that he either go on the chat room that doesn't require a license, or spend a couple of weeks and brush up on some stuff and go online. You could have an online DE test every day of the week. They're readily available these days. Kabung, you got yourself a tech license and you can legitimately talk on the air. So I try to give people the benefit of the doubt, even though I was brought up in Brooklyn where we're taught not to do such things. But, you know, education, I think, is always important. So if you legitimately think that these guys are just not very bright about it, the best thing is to make them brighter.
Sounds good. Thank you for addressing the topic. I appreciate the response. KD2VHD, clear and listening.
Okay, very good, Jim. This is a subject that we don't really bring up that much because, Jewish people have this thing called Tanahara, evil eye. If you talk about things, that they suddenly appear. So I guess I'm near enough wood to knock on it a lot when I'm in a superstitious mood. Anyway, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Mess. So if you're out there and you got either a question or a topic for discussion or a comment to make, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, unfortunately, two people doubled. So the gentleman whose call sign ended in uniform, please repeat yourself now.
AD2DU, Alex in Astoria.
Okay, very good. Alex recognized the other gentleman whose call sign didn't end in a U. Please identify.
Yes, this is N2PIT Kenny, and I have a question.
Okay, very good, Kenny. You're second on the list for right now. First on the list, Alex, AD2DU, what's your question or your topic for tonight?
So I moved this setup across the house, and on some bands on FT8, I'm getting RF back in the shack. So it's, you know, hitting the touchscreen doorbell and turning off the keyboard, whatever. How bad of a problem is that? Meaning, if I can't figure it out right away, do you cease operation immediately until you do more testing? Or is the fact that the keyboard turns off, like, a nuisance? Does it hurt the radio? 82 to you.
Okay, it sort of depends upon the radiation, the amount of radiation. Dick, may rest in peace, K2RIW would regularly rail on these reports that the cell phones will give you cancer or something. RF is non-ionizing radiation. It does not produce by itself genetic defect mutations that ultraviolet and X-rays, gamma rays and such can do. But it can produce heat, and heat can cause damage. The most sensitive RF heat damage to the human body occurs in closed spaces like the eyeball. So cell phones right next to your head can be a little bit sketchy at times. But nevertheless, you know, a lot of people use them, and there's no particular proof that there's anything wrong. It can range anywhere from a nuisance to a health threat. There are ways of calculating the approximate amount of RF that's being emanated. The ARRL has a page. I put up a page, I'm trying to remember, someplace on some website, because Mike, I think, provided the formula. But there are more than a few places where you can look up the radiation measurements, approximate calculated one, based on your power output and the type of antenna you have and the distance that any one is. Most radios are kind of more bulletproof than computers and other things. So you'll probably disrupt a lot of other things before you destroy your radio with errant RF. It can range from simple things like rebooting your computer or resetting your virtual devices or real devices or USB interfaces and such. Theoretically, if it really got into a unprotected, unshielded piece of non-specific electronic equipment, it could cause electrical potentials that burn out very sensitive circuits. But radios is probably the last thing that's going to go.
The second piece is if I have an HF and a UHF radio, and I'm listening to you on the VHF-UHF, and I do FDA on HF. If you can hear static on the VHF-UHF, meaning something from one antenna is getting into the other one, is there a way to tell how bad that is? Is like, is it going to hurt the radio again, or can I just tolerate it? AD2 to you.
Well, if it's going to damage the radio, it would damage the radio. What it is doing is something called desensing. So what happens is your front end of your radio is a very sensitive device, and but not terribly selective. Frequencies that you're not listening, not VHF. Right now you're listening to me on the repeater on VHF, but on an HF signal, say it's at 10 meters, if it's strong enough, it will cause the amplifier in the front end of your radio to become less sensitive, and that will be presented as a noisier signal when you're listening to the radio. So desensing is kind of the first stage. You probably have to go significant orders of magnitude greater where you might fry the front end. So desensing is just annoying. I get it all the time, unfortunately, because the farthest distance I can do my two VHF antennas is about 30 feet. So when one of them is transmitting, the other one is trying to listen to another repeater, and it's picking up static because of that desensing. And there's not much you can do except separate them. Putting in high-Q filters would be rather cost-prohibitive.
Did it desensitize the radio permanently?
No, it's a temporary thing. After your transmission is finished, the circuits should kind of equilibrate back to their standard sensitivity.
great. That's good news. So I'll tolerate it and keep doing FTA during the tech night. 80 CDU.
Okay. I wish you good luck. I hope you get a lot of wallpaper, a lot of work, or whatever. Have fun. You're not the only one. There have been other people. Who tried to do FT8 during the technical net. One particular gentleman, I think, found it unrewarding. You know, he liked more of a challenge. If you could do two things at the same time, I guess that's not a big challenge for some people. So, you know, I wish you good luck with it. But, yeah, just don't worry about it. I mean, if you want to decrease the amount of defensing, you could decrease the amount of output power on the transmitter, but probably, you know, it's just a slight annoyance as far as you're concerned. So I don't see any real problem.
Perfect. Thank you. I get FTA's a little point and click, but it's really fun to get Russia and Japan. Like, I'm not getting there on single fiber, so... fun to see something new in the law, maybe two to you.
Yeah, I understand. Unfortunately, it comes precariously close to, you know, robotics. Last week, I did a little spiel on ChatGPT, which is artificial intelligence. There are these days FT8 robot programs where you really don't have to be in the room anymore. You know, about 6 months ago, you at least had to kind of sit there nearby and every so often click something. But now it is possible, apparently, to just automate the whole process and go off and have a nice time, and you come back and you have a whole bunch of contacts. I don't know. That kind of separates the exercise from people's humanity a little too much for me.
I did actually ask ChatGPT for a ham radio puzzle earlier. It didn't give me one that was usable for the testnet, but I tried it. 82 to you.
Oh, very good. Thank you. I didn't think of trying it because I tested it out. I find it very clever, which is a weird thing to say, but it is inherently, at least in my experiences, more descriptive than explanative. It sort of tells you that something happened without kind of explaining why that thing happens to happen. I have a big technical question that I have asked electrical engineers. Unfortunately, I don't know any physicists. The Maxwell's equation kind of would demonstrate that the electric and magnetic fields start off in the near field in out of phase with each other. And yet when they get to be about a wavelength away, their alignment tends to coincide and they become in phase. And my big question has always been, how does that change? How do you go from something that's out of phase at the origin point to something in phase at one wavelength? And I asked ChatGPT, gave me a very nice description of it happening without an explanation of why it happened. So I never thought of giving it the puzzle question. But that's interesting, because I would eventually probably try that. They're very difficult to find. Some people don't kind of understand that. And, you know, surprisingly, and, you know, I try not to just make them riddles or just trivial facts, but, you know, something a little bit more twisty than that. But thanks for trying.
Yeah, define ham radio related puzzle as if that phrase were a noun, and then I ask it again. It showed me to decode Morse code. 82 to you.
Okay. Oh well. What can you do? Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that you could do. People out there who are interested in AI, it's readily available. It's very strange. It doesn't do math well, I'm told. It has been optimized for conversation, which is why they call it ChatGPT. GPT is a AI, massive AI algorithm that's trainable in different ways. The latest, greatest is 3.0. The ChatGPT is supposedly on a slightly improved engine, and some consider it GPT 3.5. The rate for GPT 4.0, which probably can read our minds. But you can kind of convince it that 2 plus 2 equals 22, and it'll go along with it. So, you know, it's gullible. It's a gullible artificial intelligence.
I'm assuming it finds its mainstream real-world use, like taking your order at TGI Friday.
I think they already have those things. They're, you know, I mean, unfortunately, my understanding is some schools are using software that can detect ChatGPT-generated papers. Apparently, that's becoming a problem. Students are clever people, and if they find a get-around, they will use it. So it's being used in school as we speak, no doubt.
Well, thank you for your help, Roy. I'll be clear. And looking forward to the statement. 82 to you.
Okay, very good. Next up is Kenny, N2PIP. What's your question, topic, or comment for tonight, Kenny?
Yes, this is N2PIP. Good evening to the net. And I have a question that possibly you or somebody can answer for me. On Echolink, are there any restrictions having a technician license? I'm under the impression, and I did a little reading, and I was wondering, can I just operate freely on Echolink? And like if it's a 10-meter repeater, can I go through the 10-meter repeater? Even though I'm coming through Echolink, I'm not actually using a frequency to get to a 10-meter repeater. As far as coming through, let's say, on my Android phone, we'll use that as an example. But I was wondering if there's any restrictions or do I have an open play on that. Back to net. This is November 2, Pop Andy and Tango.
Okay, Kenny, is my understanding that you are still limited to the frequency coverage of your license. The fact that you got into the transmitter there via internet protocol does not obviate it. So, in other words, and 10 meters is an interesting place. There's a lot of areas in 10 meters where you as a technician have privileges. One of the things I do every Sunday at 11 o'clock is a 10-meter net on 28.380 upper sideband. The reason why we picked that area is because that is available to technicians, generals, and extras all. So most likely the 10-meter repeater is going to be located in a portion of the band that is acceptable for technicians. But generally speaking, if you don't have privileges for the frequency, even though you got to the transmitter secondhand, that doesn't relieve you from your responsibility. There are Echolink nodes out there that are connected to legitimate full-function HF radios where you can dial it up any HF frequency and transmit. So obviously the rule would go wacky if just because you were Echolink nodes linking to it, you no longer have the limitations. So I wish I could tell you that it was a free ticket, but you still have the FCC limitations.
A comment?
Certainly, Kenny.
Good evening, everyone. This is Alpha Delta 2 Bravo Oscar 82 BO. First, I just want to make sure I'm accessing the repeater okay.
Yes, you're full quieting.
Thanks a lot. Again, our name is Russell. If the station is Peter, and he's transmitting on an input frequency in VHF or UHF, and the repeater is now retransmitting his signal on the repeater's output on the 10-meter frequency, even though the station with the tech license is transmitting on VHF and UHF, and he's not transmitting on the 10-meter band, the repeater is, you know what? He's still the temporary control operator of the repeater. So even though he's transmitting, a technician transmitting on VHF, UHF, and the repeater is transmitting the output on the 10-meter band, I do not believe that is a good transmission because he is the temporarily control operator of the repeater, and I do believe he's inadvertently transmitting outside his frequency privilege. Technicians are licensed on 10 meters from 28.0 to 28.500. If the repeater is transmitting on the output in the digital portion of the band, he's okay. But if it's not, then he's not okay. So you'd have to look closely at the output frequency of the 10-meter end of the repeater there. Over.
Yes, I would agree with you totally, Russell. It has to do with the output frequency of the transmitter. The EchoLink, the person connected to EchoLink is doing the transmitting. You can kind of say that he's just going through the internet, but ultimately it's actuating a transmitter. He is responsible for all of his transmissions and the frequencies that they come out in. So, you know, in the case of EchoLink repeater, the input frequency is not important because he's not using the input frequency. But, you know, any method of transmitting outside of the frequency allocation for a technician's license is an FCC violation. So I agree with you, Russell.
I tell you what, though, that's an excellent, excellent question. I had to think about that one for a second. I could see how that would be misleading because you're not transmitting on the repeater's output frequency. But yeah, very good. I hope that answers the question. I think it did. All right, gentlemen, 82BO.
Yes, I think we answered Kenny's question, but we'll go back to Kenny and just make sure. Did we answer your question as you wanted?
Yes, 105%. Even 110%. Yes, it is. And this is N2PIC returning. It's exactly what I thought, but I just want to get a second and a third opinion on it, and I did get it. And it's just the way I figured it would be, and in the way it should be. Yes, I know about the sideband mode. I used to work sideband many years ago when I had my own home. But now I live in a condo, so I don't have the ability to put up an HF antenna, a 10-meter whip, or a 10-meter antenna, I should say, so I can get on 28.3 to 28.5 and do some sideband work. And especially now I understand the band is starting to pop. So with that being said, I do thank you very much for coming back to me, and it definitely just confirmed what I thought, and it went along with everything that I was thinking. So, yes, you did answer the question in full, and I'll put it back over to Ned, and I thank you so much again for coming back to my call. This is N2PIT, and I'll say good evening to everybody on the net, and back to Net Control.
Okay, very good, Kenny. You know where we are. If you have any questions in the future, feel free to drop in and ask them. I mean, it would be a really enormous loophole. Now, you mentioned a situation that is not, unfortunately, uncommon to many amateur radio operators, being in locations where they simply can't put up antennas, and other people, entrepreneurs, are making a couple of bucks by providing their answer. Remote Ham is a company that originally were a bunch of big-time antenna riggers that kind of got out of the antenna rigging business completely, set up their own model contest station, and allowed people to rent time on them. So if the FCC has kind of taken a different look at it, anyone without even a license, you know, since you logged into it via the internet initially, the fact that you transmit on the HF band secondarily, if they let you get away with that, then you wouldn't even need licenses. You just need a credit card, go away with it. So, yeah, that's a loophole that thankfully doesn't exist. I just want to mention, because Kenny brought it up, 10 meters out there, usually I haven't gotten much response one way or the other, but 10 meters is very lively once again. I run, as I mentioned, a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, approximately on 28.380 up the sideband. I spoke to stations as far west as Washington State and as far east as the country of Ireland. So I had a fun time. The things were very busy on 10 meters today. So if you haven't checked out 10 meters lately, consider doing it. It's loads of fun. Anyone else with any comments or questions out there?
WA2CXR.
Yes, CXR.
Good evening. While on the topic of HF propagation, the last 2 weeks I have experienced very high noise levels. Forget about the signals. Only the strong ones are being heard. But I'm talking 1.8 through, 14.35 megahertz. And nevertheless, with a vertically polarized antenna, but still pretty high. Is it local, or is it beyond just my geographic location?
Well, I know you like the answer, but both it's complicated and both. Noise is made up of a whole bunch of different components. Theoretically, vertical antennas tend to be more noisy than horizontal. The general theory behind that is that local electromagnetic radiation noise tends to favor a vertical orientation than a horizontal one. One of the problems with noise is that the propagation conditions I mentioned for 10 meters has a negative impact on the lower band. What you want for propagation on 10 meters is a nice, hot, ionized F1, F2 layer that will give you refraction and bounce all over the world. What you do not want if you're into 160 meters or 80 meters is ionization, because the D layer produces a lot of background noise. The reason why no one in their right mind will operate 160 meters or 80 meters in the middle of the day is because the sun is lighting up the D layer and the noise floor is rising. So part of it is the ionization itself. It has a more detrimental effect at the lower frequencies of the HF. You get a lot of it at 160 and 80, a little bit of it at 40, just fade mostly at 20 and 10 and up is loves the sun. So it's that. There are all kinds of background electromagnetic wave crashes and contaminants and schmutz in the air. When you travel to a industrial urban environment, it increases exponentially. Everyone has a wall wart. Everyone has a fluorescent phallus. There are industrial offices, stores, and such that have RF noisy components, and so it mounts up. And some people in their own house have things that contaminate locally, producing RF noise. So RF noise is a very complicated and a very broad topic. So as I mentioned, some of it is global, some of it is solar-based and ionospheric-based, and some of it is very local.
Okay. So in other words, 10 over 9 noise level to be expected, but the 40 meters north. I don't know. It was never this bad for this long. I'm assuming your answer means it's not. It could be local, but most likely it's not.
Well, again, it's a combination of things. If you ever talk to people who used to live in city or suburban environments, and you know they travel down south and got themselves a quiet little house out in the boonies, one of the remarks that they'll make is that the noise floor has dropped out from under them. You know, I'll even hear that from people who operate upstate New York. So it's a different world living. You don't have to live in the middle of Manhattan. You can live in Long Island. It's close enough to all the urban electrical signals. So in this area, a significant portion is just general RF noise from the high population density and the high use of electrical devices that are not very clean. But in addition to it, especially when you're talking in terms of the lower frequencies, you're going to have during sunspot activity high, most people talk about the 10-meter band, 6-meter band opening up. They don't usually talk too much about the 160-meter band and 80-meter band getting noisier. So again, it's complex and it's a combination of a bunch of things. So I wouldn't definitively say it's all the sunspot activity or it's all just global RF noise. You know, it's a lot of everything combined.
Oh, okay. Very thorough. Thank you for that answer. Just going to have to find another hobby. WA2TXR clear.
Well, as I said before, you might want to shift your emphasis on the higher HF band where the conditions, rather than rooting them, are improving them. I don't want to sound like a 10-meter booster, but the noise floor is relatively acceptable most of the time on 10 meters. And because of the propagation conditions across the world.
Oh, I have to validate you on 28.7 and the noise level is an S4. On 21 megahertz, it's an S7. So high. And then we go to 14 and it's up to 10 to 20 over 9. Which confirms what you say. Alright, thanks again.
Well, you're welcome. I hope you find a way to enjoy this hobby. You just have to be a little bit flexible. There's never a time that I'm aware of where, you know, it's just impossible, other than, I think, World War I and World War II, where they basically locked up everyone that transmitted during that. So other than that, you might have to readjust your expectations. But, there's always a way. Okay, very good. Once again, I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limewatch Technical Map. So if anyone has any other questions or comments or topics for tonight, feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign. Paul and Ivan recognize. Ivan, do you have a question tonight?
Yeah, just basically I'm shopping for a radio transceiver, and two people told me that I was going to buy, save some money and buy the one mode old mode transceiver, like digital ICON channel 5. It does HF, it does VHF and UHF. Somebody told me, like, there's an issue there, and I'm better off to get a HF transceiver to have a from VHF and UHF. Is there any grain of truth in that?
Well, I haven't really heard anything terrible. I've heard kind of vague rumors that I haven't been able to really hunt down. Maybe some other people listening tonight have been able to hunt them down. The 705 is a very nice radio, and it is what we call an all-in-one. My first station radio was a ICOM 7100, which is also an all-in-one. The only downside with the 705, in my humble opinion, is it's sort of designed to be taken portable, which is great if you're planning to use it portable. If you plan to use it as a base station, it only puts out 10 watts. Most base station radios, people tend to want a 100-watt transmitter, so you would have to get...